what we have here is a very active group of young people, millennials, and they were originally out there every day, you know, marching up and down with signs and attending the LA City Council meetings about withdrawing our funds, for the city's funds, from Wells Fargo due to, you know, fraud and corruption and all those things that Wells Fargo was found guilty of. Right now we have 15 active measures going, you know, that are actually being pursued in legislatures across the country. We would argue it should be. The central bank should be our money. It should be where our money comes from. Congress could change the rules. They drafted it in the first place. They could change the Federal Reserve Act and say, this is now going to be a national bank to serve the people. Somebody else has this big pot of money and they are using it to basically colonize us.
Are you having trouble losing weight? It could be due to insulin levels that are out of balance. Learn what fat-flushing food helps balance your insulin levels. It's basically a hormone that determines how much fat your body stores. Over 240,000 women have successfully melted unwanted fat off their body fast, faster than you would think possible, keeping it off for good. Learn how so many people have melted fat so quickly. Click the link below.
Changers, I'm Sarah Westall. Today I have a great show lined up with Ellen Brown. She is one of the smartest people I know. She is the chief officer of the Public Banking Institute, and I got to tell you, it really is how we can go about ending the Fed. And there's initiatives going on in Los Angeles to vote on putting a public bank in place. There's stuff going on in Seattle, in New Jersey, and North Dakota has had one for over 100 years. And so there's a great model to show people how it really works. And it's really educational. And anybody who understands how the Fed works knows that it's broken and that it doesn't benefit the people. Especially when it was set up in 1913, it was set up just to benefit a few foreigners. And now nobody really knows who owns it today. So we really got to get to a point where the benefits go back to our country and it stays with our country and the agendas are aligned with the people of this country. That's how things need to be set up. Anybody that says, well, it's not that way because the structure of the country was set up back at the Revolutionary War differently. I say, if it's set up one way, it can be set up another way. That's where I'm at. And I think we just say enough of it. We want this to be set up differently. Then she sticks around to talk to my patrons about what is going on with Trump and the Fed, and also some other topics as well. Very interesting. I love talking to Ellen Brown. So for those of you who are my patrons, I have a link below. It's only $1 a month. So if you want to join, I'd really appreciate it. You can do more than $1. It's how I keep this show going. So let's get into my interview now with Ellen Brown. Hi, Ellen. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Sarah. Great to talk to you, as always.
You have an amazing initiative going on in Los Angeles, and that has to do with everything that you've been working on for decades with this public banking, much like they did in North Dakota. They have an initiative going on in Los Angeles. Can you talk about that? And I mean, this is a big deal.
Thanks. Actually, it is rather like North Dakota's because it was a populist movement. What we have here is a very active group of young people, millennials, and they were originally out there every day, you know, marching up and down with signs and attending the LA City Council meetings about withdrawing our funds, for the city's funds, from Wells Fargo due to, you know, fraud and corruption and all those things that Wells Fargo was found guilty of. And so the city council actually did that. And now, then the question was, well, where are you going to put the money? Another Wall Street bank, they've all been found guilty of something or other. You know, it's just not the model we're looking for here. So then when they learned about public banking, it was like the obvious solution. Of course, we need to have our own bank. We can cut out all the middlemen. We can save a lot of money. We can make sure that our money is focused in our city to benefit our people, that sort of thing. So even if you have a totally honest Wall Street bank, you're still not getting the benefit of your funds, if you know what I mean. So we send off billions of dollars to Wall Street as deposits, on which we get, the city gets almost no interest. And then they use those deposits that legally, they actually own those deposits. So they use those deposits for investments of various sorts, but they're not the investments we would have made, and they're not investments back in our community. Meanwhile, we paid, I think, $170 million just in banking fees last year, and $1.4 billion in interest, all of which could be coming back to the city if we were using our own bank, leveraging our own funds. So the city actually has brought an initiative. I guess they had talked to their legal counsel, and legal counsel said, well, you can't do it because there's this charter provision in the charter that says you can't do it unless you have voter approval. So they, of their own initiative, brought a measure for voter approval that will go on the ballot in November to 4 million people. And it turned out that I was the designated author on this thing. So on the argument in support, 300 words, which was due yesterday. So anyway, this is cool that the city wants to do it, and they're coming to us for help. We've done a lot of initiatives in the last 10 years since we've been at it, or let's see, I guess technically maybe 7 years since we've been at it, since the Public Banking Institute was founded, of which I am the chairman. And we've lost, a number of them have died a ritual death, as I saw somebody described it, died a ritual death in committee. So right now we have 15 active measures going, that are actually being pursued in legislatures across the country. But if you total them all up, and we've probably had 50. So it keeps going. And at the Public Banking Institute, we do a newsletter, and we thought, well, we'd kind of cool it, and only do a newsletter when something important happens. But it turns out something important is happening every week. So we have news every week, and articles are appearing all across the country in different cities where they're interested in pursuing a public bank. So anyway, it's definitely a growing movement. In New York, there was the Poor People's, the march that they did. They are public bank supporters, and they were interviewed on that. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a public bank supporter, and she's been interviewed on it, and she'll be out here for the Left Coast Forum at the end of this month, which I will also be speaking at. So we have a lot going on. Yep.
This is a movement that's supported by all sides of the political spectrum, right? I mean, I consider this a nonpartisan movement that, unless you don't understand banking, you are for it. I mean, it's just so obvious.
Yeah, it is obvious. And so on the right, North Dakota is a very conservative state. It's the only state that has its own, or that's had a bank for the last 100 years. Right now, American Samoa is the second U.S. territory, at least, to have formed its own publicly owned bank that the Federal Reserve gave them a master account for. But anyway, the Bank of North Dakota is very Republican, and for them, it's all about keeping their money local, using it for their own purposes. So it's conservative in that sense. Conserve our money for our purposes, cut out the middlemen, and give low interest loans into the community and the property.
Over 400 million people worldwide suffer from IBS, SIBO, leaky gut, or other related digestive disorders. If you are one of those suffering, you are not alone. There's a free health summit on these digestive disorders that runs September 3rd through the 10th, and you will learn from experts on cutting-edge research and protocols. They'll help you understand and identify the root causes of your digestive struggles. They'll help you save money from wasted doctor visits and ineffective treatments. Identify which foods cause your flares. You'll learn important principles for gut healing, strategies for food reintroduction, treatments, protocols, and much more. Sign up with the link below.
Well, it just seems so obvious that this would be a better solution. It's fiscally conservative or fiscally more responsible, and it helps the entire community do better. And it's obvious once people understand what's really going on, this is what people want to do, right? I mean, who would be against it?
Yeah. Well, the arguments we get in opposition, we already know what the opposition is going to say. One thing they will say is, do you really want politicians managing our money? But of course, we're not talking about politicians managing the money. It's bankers. They will hire seasoned bankers to do prudent banking. And the government already handles a lot of money. They already know how to handle our money. They, for example, the state of California has an infrastructure bank that makes very large loans, or that all sorts of municipal government make loans of different sorts. So they have funds for these loans. So they already know how to prudently make these loans, find out whether whoever they're lending it to is a good risk, et cetera. They're already basically doing banking, but the part that we want to add is the depository part. So if you take that same money that you're lending, let's say you have a pot of money to lend for, let's call it an affordable housing fund. And if you lend that money out at 3% and you wait for a year and it comes back, or you wait until the loan's paid off, and then you can lend it again. So you make 3% on your money. But you could take that same pot of money, call it capital, capitalize a bank, you can now lend it 10 times. You can lend 10 times as much, so you can make 30% on that money. But in order to do that, you need deposits equal to 10 times that much, or conservatively, more like 12 times that much. So you can, but as a city or as a state, you've got the deposits. Your deposits are now sitting in Wall Street earning almost nothing. So bring those back, pay them what they're getting now, you know, and then that's part of your costs, and you will have to deduct that from your 30%. But you're still going to make a lot better return than you were making just lending your money out once.
Well, go ahead.
Plus, you will have greatly expanded your ability to create credit for the community. Let's say it's for infrastructure. All those infrastructure loans pay back if you're building if you're building something that pays. Let's say you're building a train, then you can pay it back with fees. It's like the Chinese. They just issue the money. Well, they borrow it, but they borrow it from their own bank, which just issues the money, which is how all banking works. So they issue the money. They build something with it, and then that thing generates profits, which pay the loan back. So it doesn't hurt to spend 10 times as much into the community when you are making these loans for productive purposes, which will actually stimulate the economy, add jobs, all that stuff, because you will get the money back.
Well, okay, let's simplify it even. Right now, they're already managing their own money. They manage their pot, right? Whether you change it or not, they're still managing the same amount of money. Now we're just saying, do you want to take all that extra money that you could get and just give it to the bank and you don't get it? Or you give it back to yourself and you can manage it. It's like, well, what's better? Politicians doing it. Well, at least, these are the options. We have the money and politicians can use it and invest in the community, or you don't get any of it. Nobody manages it except them and they get all the money. So it's like, well, that's the options. It's like, okay, do we want politicians to manage it? Or do we want nothing at all? That's what they're giving you as a decision. Well, obviously, at least with politicians managing it, at least we get it back and we have a chance. The way we have it now with the private going to Wall Street, we get zero of it and it just costs us money. So it's not an argument. It's kind of like absurd.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's the thing. If you don't trust your own elected officials, who do you trust more? Your elected officials or a Wall Street banker that you didn't elect at all and that has no mandate, no responsibility for using that money to serve you? They can use it for their purposes.
Well, but they don't. But the whole thing is, the last 100 years or whatever, they didn't use it for you at all. So the options are, you don't get it at all, or your politicians get to manage it. And your politicians will put people in place who are bankers who know what they're doing that'll allow you to do it smart. Yeah, there's all sorts of openings for corruption and crap to go on, but at least you have an ability to get it. Now you got it. Before, you didn't get it at all. Nothing. It's like, yeah. Well, that's so obvious. At least we have a chance.
Yeah. Plus, it's totally transparent, and they must use it responsibly. In other words, we the people can see where this money's going, and if it's not going for good purposes, we don't reelect those people, or even we sue them, or you know, bring lawsuits, or get rid of them in some way if they're doing something very corrupt.
I just think it's so obvious. Your options are, it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
Nothing. Or we get it, and we get the chance of really doing something great with it.
Right, right.
You get to starve yourself, or you get food. You better feed your... This is what they're saying. Well, is it better not to be eating junk food? Well, I'd rather have food, and then we get a chance to figure out... I mean, that really is the difference. You either starve yourself completely, which is what is going on now, or you get food. And there's a chance you might end up eating junk food, but at least you get, you know, you can try to make it nutritious. And that's the zero-sum game. So I think it's absolutely absurd to do what we have right now. And I think people need to understand that. That's why I think it's on the political spectrum that everyone should, who can understand this, should be for it. Yeah, I'm not a big government person. I don't like government either. But at least, I mean, the alternative is nothing. And you're just, I mean, it makes no sense.
Yeah, agreed.
It's laughable, well, right?
It's
laughable.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we have this one model that's been there for 100 years. So they can't say, well, it's new and untested and we don't want to take the risk. The Bank of North Dakota has done brilliantly well. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal in November 2014 that said that the Bank of North Dakota was more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs. And how do they do it? They cut out the middlemen. They don't have high-paid CEOs. They don't have shareholders that are taking short-term profits and have their eyes on short-term profits. They can think for the long term, and they have very few costs. In other words, they've cut out. They don't have buildings. They don't have tellers because they're really basically a banker's bank that works with the local banks. They partner with the local bank. They don't compete with the local banks. So anyway, it's a very good model and a very well-established model. So we can point to that and say, no, it works. It works very well.
Now, what are some of the wrenches they can throw onto the tracks to mess you up that the public needs to be aware of so that when this happens, I mean, because obviously there's going to be people are going to be throwing wrenches in, or once it's established like North Dakota, they can't.
So you're talking about wrenches after we get it established?
Yeah, let's say get it established. What kind of wrenches, what kind of things can they mess up so that it looks like it's a failure, even though what kinds of things do you have to make sure that you put in place so that they don't screw it up? Because obviously the powers that be that don't want it there are going to do what they can to mess it up. What kinds of things is everybody for thinking so that when we do get this in place, we can't, you know, I know the model of North Dakota is such a great model. So how do you make sure that when you establish it, you don't have some clown trying to mess it up?
Well, one thing that the people in this whole movement are very adamant about is establishing principles, the things that can be invested in. And in other words, we'll have guidelines. So it's a government of laws, you know, not people. So we're not depending on some city manager to do it right. They have to follow these guidelines, and we're setting the guidelines out to make sure that it goes in the appropriate, you know, that they follow prudent investment policy and environmentally and socially responsible investment. You know, right now we have, there are things like, I just wrote about this, Blackstone, you know, is a big hedge fund, basically. And they bought up all these properties when they crashed after 2008. And now they're renting them back to people at very high rents. So that's one reason we have a huge housing problem here, a rental problem. So who's investing in Blackstone? Our pension funds. They like the California state pension funds, which has $1 trillion. I mean, they're not putting it all in Blackstone, obviously, but they are looking for it. They put their money in investments that make money, but they don't have any rule that says, well, we can't invest in something that's actually coming back to bite us, that's actually hurting our people. So that's what we want to put in there to make sure that these investments are not only prudent, you know, not only lucrative and responsible fiscally, but also responsible socially and environmentally. I mean, we have to be very careful because you don't want to say no oil, or because there will be people on the other side who disagree with that. You know what I mean? You can make an argument for many things. Like even, well, I watch all those videos on Agenda 21. You know, I don't even dare bring that up to my friends who are very,
you know. you can't get into the tinfoil hat stuff. So, you got to stay.
All these things that look like they might be good for us might be bad for us, and there might be some big conspiracy behind it. So we have to be very careful how we frame this. So it would just be a general thing, but we want it to be responsible, not only in terms of making money, but in terms of actually serving the people.
Beautiful. That's excellent. And that's where the politicians supposedly come in. That's what their role is to make sure that at the end of the day, we're doing some good things for the people. That's why they're elected. Now, I'm not a big government person either, but at the same time, we have to come up with some rules. I would think it would be important to stay apolitical with this. It has to be bipartisan. This is not a political thing. This should reach, because every part of the spectrum it agrees with this. Basically, I always say, if you understand banking, you agree with this. It's not whether you're a Republican or Democrat or Libertarian or whatever. It's just basically, do you understand banking or not? Because if you understand what's going on, you're for this. If you don't, then maybe you can get brainwashed to think differently. So your goals are to figure out how to make it so that it just is not political.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So now how big of a deal is this? I know North Dakota is already established, and that's a big deal in and of itself. But how big of a deal is it that one of the largest cities in the country are now moving forward and doing this?
Well, it's a very big deal to us because it's 4 million people who have never even heard of public banking, most of them. And we have 3 months to enlighten them on what we're talking about. That's why there was so much pressure on writing this memo for yesterday.
So with LA being such a big deal, how do you think that, I mean, I know you're hoping that it will really affect other cities and other things. You said you have 15 other initiatives going on. Where are these things going?
You mean which states or what?
Which other cities and states? And yeah, what do you got going on? This is, and they, are any of them as close to going to ballot to vote as LA is?
Well, the LA vote is only on allowing the city to do it. They would still have to come up with a business plan that everybody agrees on. I think it needs to go to the voters again after they get a business plan. So in that sense, we're not real close. You know, it could still take quite a while. I'd say maybe Seattle might be the closest, or New Jersey. New Jersey's governor, Phil Murphy, newly elected, ran on a platform of a state-owned bank, and it's within 2 weeks of his inauguration, two of his senators brought a bill for a New Jersey state-owned bank. But you know, things always get stalled for one reason or another. Apparently, in New Jersey, he has other budget problems, so he's dealing with those, and so this one is. That's how it goes.
You know what's so amazing is that doing this will solve a lot of your budget problems. The amount of extra money that you have coming back to the state is a lot. There's the political pressure now, is it just people not understanding how banking works, or is there a lot of money going in because the Wall Street banks don't want you doing it? And so is there a lot of money funding the propaganda against it?
There is propaganda against it. I don't know that a lot of money is going into it, but it's always an uphill battle to change the mindset of people or the prevailing model. So I'm actually not discouraged, since we do have a lot of momentum now. People understand what public banking means. And if you mention the Bank of North Dakota, they will have heard of it. Some people will have heard of it at least, whereas it used to be nobody had ever heard of it. So it's slow going, but I think we'll eventually, if they got it, like you say, it actually serves everybody. I would love to be able to do a model where it served Wall Street as well. I haven't quite figured that out yet.
Well, that would be great, but
yeah.
Well, it's not going to, I mean, right now they get 100% of it. And so taking any of it, you know, now we're saying, okay, instead of you getting 100% of it, it's just going to the people. I don't, you know, it's a no brainer, but I can see how Wall Street wouldn't like that. Now, how could this model be used on a national?
Well, that's just what I just finished a book on that, which isn't in print yet, but it should come out later this year, called Banking on the People. Banking on the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age. So there are several central banker research groups and ex-treasury advisors and professors that have written, like there are three different papers that I've seen in just this last 6 months, where they're recommending opening up the central bank to everyone. In other words, we would all be able to have a deposit at the central bank. I mean, you could, if you want, question their motives, because we are talking about central bankers or central bank researchers talking about this. But there are a lot of possible advantages to this. At the moment, we have two different banking systems. The banks bank with the Fed. They get 2% on their deposits. It's all, they don't have, you know, there's no fees. They have instant money transfers with their Fed wires. And we don't get to use that money. That it's Federal Reserves. The Fed creates reserves, and quantitative easing was all about the Fed buying stuff with their reserves off the books of the banks. So the reserves went onto the books of the banks, and whatever they bought came to the Fed. But it was all within that Federal Reserve system. It never came into the real economy. Now, what we deal in, except the little bit that is cash, 95% of our money supply is bank money. In other words, it's not real money. It's not central bank issued. I know we can argue about whether the central bank really is, but it's the closest thing we've got. It could be. In other words, we would argue it should be. The central bank should be our money. It should be where our money comes from, or you could say the treasury. But here's the thing. The central bank is a bank. It's already set up to be a bank. It manages something like 2.5 trillion deposit accounts and $3 trillion daily. I mean, they know how to do banking. So if you tried to give that to the treasury, you'd have to start all over again. But let's just say we nationalize the central bank. The central bank was mandated. Congress could change the rules. They drafted it in the first place. They could change the Federal Reserve Act and say, this is now going to be a national bank to serve the people. Everybody gets to bank there. The advantages, besides getting 2% on our deposits, which we don't get now, you would eliminate bank runs, because the Federal Reserve is the ultimate deep pocket. They can't run out of money, so the bank is not going to go bankrupt. You wouldn't need FDIC insurance. You wouldn't need that $250,000 limit on FDIC insurance, so the big depositors wouldn't have to find somewhere else to put their money, which right now what they do is they put it in the repo market, and it was actually the repo market that collapsed in 2008, not the conventional banks. It was the shadow banking system. It was a run on the shadow banking system. We could effectively eliminate the shadow banking system. We could also effectively eliminate the big Wall Street banks.
Well, you know, and you're not the only one that have said that. I've had a lot of big people, Ed Moy being one of them, saying, you know, banking, there really isn't a need for banking in the future, some of those banks.
Yeah.
But keep going.
So if the Wall Street wants to play, they could agree to be nationalized. You know, they could, if they want to join the game, as long as they agree to be civil servants like the Bank of North Dakota and to take a modest salary and all those things that we would expect, they could have big powers. You know, it could be a very exciting job to be the head of JP Morgan Chase, which is like the largest bank in the world, which had the U.S. government behind it. I know I'm going to raise all kinds of red flags, like you really want JP Morgan Chase in our system. But anyway, the point is we can basically run them out of business because nobody's going to want to put their money in Chase for almost no interest when Chase could go bankrupt and they could wind up with this, bail-ins where they lose their money altogether, all the things that could go wrong in a big private bank that can go bust. If they can get 2% on their deposits from the central bank, which can't go bankrupt, and they get, you know, no fees on their accounts, instant credit or instant transfers, all those benefits that you would get from putting your money in a truly nationalized central bank. I mean, we'd have to be very careful to make sure that it was really there to serve the people and wasn't some sort of scam. I mean, I know that it'll be a while before people agree to that, but I could see it as a potential.
Well, and that's the problem in general. People are worried about the government because there's so much corruption. But the way we have it now, I keep going back to it. The way we have it now is it's a zero-sum game. Zero of it, or at least we get a chance to try to do something with it. And right now, it's not even a zero-sum game. It's a negative game because that money is actually being used against us in a lot of cases. We're not only giving it out, but now that our money is being invested in things that hurt us. Like you said, with the Blackstone investment group that was bought all those houses and then renting it back at much higher amounts. So we're taking our money, giving it to somebody else to use it against us. And that in and of itself, we could put an end to. You know, we have a chance. It's going from knowing we have a negative situation to going to a chance to make it a hell of a lot better. Now, and this is why you're afraid to talk about JP Morgan. There's so much evidence and proof and factual proof and legal proof and documented proof in courts and everything else of all the things that they've done, not only to our own citizens, but overseas as well. And that's what people are scared of. And how do you see that coming to an end? Do you know what I'm asking?
Well, the JP Morgan Chase is, and the shadow banking system are essentially one system. They serve each other. They need the shadow banking system to provide that liquidity. And it's the shadow banking system that went down globally and caused all these problems in 2008, 2009. So if you had a central bank that could do all that, you don't need the shadow banking system. You don't need that for liquidity. You've got liquidity.
Will you explain what the shadow banking system is for people who don't know?
Okay, so it's basically the repo market, which was created by places like JP Morgan Chase, so it also serves the banks. But the big investors were demanding a place to put their money, the ones with over 250,000. So the pension funds, for example, and all these other funds needed a place to put their money. And they wanted to be insured just like federal deposit insurance. So the way the repo market works is it's like a pawn shop. So you give them your money and they give you something that you technically own. So they give you probably government securities. That's the ideal collateral for this deal. So they'll give you the government security overnight, a short-term government security, and then you give it back in the morning. That's the way it works. It comes back day after day. So you technically own it. And so if the bank goes bankrupt, then the repo market investors can just take the money. They say, well, we owned it. You know, it was a pawn shop. It's ours because you didn't pay us back. And therefore, they escape bankruptcy. And that was actually the problem in 2008, that if they had been subject to bankruptcy like everybody else, then the money would have been there. Anyway, it's all very complicated. But we don't need that system is the point. We don't need that for liquidity if we have the big deep pocket for liquidity. Well, it seems to me, and what really interests me, the reason I started writing about this whole subject in 2002 was that is that we have a wrong conception about money. We think money is gold, and it's obviously we've been off the gold system for a long, long time. Money is not a thing. It's not an object. Our money system is actually the monetization of credit. So what the bank does, we say the bank creates all the money, 95% of the money, but they don't really. It's really us. We, the borrower, create the money. If you go to the grocer and try to write out an IOU to the grocer, he won't take it because he doesn't know you. At least my grocer won't because I'm in a big city. But if you go to the bank and write out an IOU, like your mortgage, you sign a promissory note, the bank will take it because he will know you. The banker will find out who you are. They'll find out how to track you down. They'll find out how to collect on this debt. And they'll collect some interest. So it's in their interest. So they'll do it. So basically what the bank does then is trade your promissory note for their promissory note, which is a checking account. They don't even give you real money. I mean, if you demand it, they will give you cash, of course. So that's why they keep 10% in reserve in their vault somewhere. But for the most part, you don't even want cash. All you want is those numbers in your account. And then you'll write a check to the seller of the house that you just bought, and they'll put the check somewhere else and it'll go into some other bank account, and it, you know, maybe they'll use their credit card against it, which is, it's all just credit. We're just turning credit into money, and that's what our money system is. So we're really just drawing credit from the cloud, and we don't need a bank that holds reserves of gold anymore. That's not the way the system works anymore. And I think it's a good system. The banking system is a good system. The only thing wrong with it is that it's privately owned. If the banks were publicly owned, if they were public utilities, so that credit is like water and power and, you know, all those things that we share, that we use together, and that we expect to be part of the public sector, then the system would work, and it would work beautifully.
Isn't it a simpler system too, once you go to the public space? I mean, because I've had people on like Wayne Jett and stuff saying that essentially, like in 1913 when they created the Federal Reserve, essentially we have foreigners. I mean, Wall Street, you know, you say Wall Street, but behind the scenes, if you trace it all back, we have a few foreigners who are benefiting from all of our money. I mean, they're not even American citizens.
Right. And it's hard to trace that back. But I know at that time that was definitely true. I mean, right now, the Federal Reserve is owned by all the banks in their district that are member banks. So you can't really prove who owns it. But certainly back when those writers were writing, it was highly suspicious. And I mean, you could trace it all the way back to the first U.S. bank, which was supposed to have been publicly owned. It started out publicly owned. But we were so far in debt that we wound up selling our interest to the British, British bankers. So it wound up privately owned, but privately owned by big foreign bankers.
Yeah, so they essentially owned a lot of controlling interests in our country. I mean, that you can control a country if you can control their money supply. Now, over time has that changed a little bit in hands, you think, with all these other banks? Or do you think we're still heavily British owned?
Well, it depends which conspiracy theory you want to follow. Well, I'd love a good conspiracy theory myself. I would say there's a lot of British control in there. But the point is that we don't own it. You know what I mean? Somebody else has this big pot of money, and they are using it to basically colonize us, you know, to
do whatever they want, whatever for
right,
their benefit, whatever their agenda is. We don't know, but it definitely, it can match our needs, but it usually doesn't. And it doesn't matter because we don't, it's whatever their agenda is. Right. I mean, it's like China's going to do things that works for them. We might get lucky and it works for both of us. We might negotiate something that works for, but at the end of the day, they're going to make decisions that work for them. And so if you have huge trillionaires that are getting this money, they're doing what works for them. The problem is that if they have too much power and influence, it gets kind of scary, especially if they're not aligned with our needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there are actually two economies going on. So there's the speculative economy, which is doing very well, and they have lots of money, and there's lots of liquidity there, and you could say there's inflation there. I mean, that's where the bubbles are, and that's what the Federal Reserve's all worried about, you know, bubbles and inflation. But then there's the worker economy or the local economy. There's our economy. And we do not have enough money in our economy. We're short of money. Everybody's in debt. There is not enough money. I mean, not everybody literally, but you know what I mean. The debt burden is huge for students and businesses and local governments and the federal government. Everybody is heavily, all those and groups are heavily in debt, and they have to pay interest on those debts. So by definition, you've got to get some new money in there to pay interest that wasn't created in the original loan, and it's not coming in. It's going off to this other speculative economy, which is just like a big parasite that lives on our economy and keeps sucking money out. So we need to get new money in there. So that would be another advantage of having a central bank that was required to be there to serve the benefit of the people, that you could use the central bank for a form of quantitative easing that actually got into the real economy, where we actually got some money out of the deal. Like for, you could do, the obvious thing is infrastructure. Use it to build infrastructure. The infrastructure will pay back. It's just like the Chinese do. It's just like Roosevelt did in the 1930s. That's how they got the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was used to just generate credit, which then rebuilt everything in the country. Some of the best architecture that we've got came from the 1930s when they had no money. How did they manage to do that? They could hire painters, you know, to put these beautiful frescoes on the walls of the post offices and stuff. Where'd they get the money for all that? They just generated credit and it paid off. It came back. You put workers to work, and they paid taxes and the money came back. And of course, they produced productivity as well, which was taxed.
Well, so, and you know, I've been saying this too in a couple different shows, is that, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz, her research where she found $22 trillion with Dr. Skidmore, Professor Skidmore, that's just from two departments. Getting the money back that was taken out of our budget without, wasn't approved by Congress. Maybe we won't get it all back. You can use collateral. There's more. That's just two departments. Getting that back and also taking the banking model and changing it to a public banking model, we could set those two things. We could get out of debt and we could set ourselves up for prosperity for hundreds of years. I mean, we could really, really change our society in an amazing way.
Yeah. Just think what we could do if everything was really geared toward serving the people. Credit is free, really. I mean, credit, there could be as much credit as there are people who want a deal. Credit is just one person gives the other person something and the other guy gives them credit, which is money, which means go spend it somewhere else. I mean, you have to draw it from somewhere, but you draw it from the debtor, you know, signs a promissory note and pays it back in some way. In other words, credit is just the means of exchange, and we can have as much exchange as we've got workers and materials available that want to get together and build some.
Yeah, we have the ability to make things great, and we know how to do it now. There's enough people, they probably knew how to do it for millennia, but there's enough people now that know how to do it. You're leading the way. But we could really, that along with recovering our stolen assets, we could really have an amazing future. I'm excited about it because that is one thing we could fix.
Yeah. Catherine Austin Fitz says that she used to think it was a closed loop system. So that's the way she built her models. And now she realizes it's not a closed loop system. There's a leak somewhere in the system. The money is going somewhere and it's not coming back. So that's what I mean. We're short of money here in the real economy, even though if you track the numbers, it looked like it's out there somewhere, but it's not in our economy. In fact, you know, it may actually be going into outer space, which is where she thinks it's going.
Well, the new space force, we've had a huge space economy part of the Air Force, and now they're separating it out as part of the Space Force. I'm hoping by separating that out, maybe it'll become, I mean, maybe this is really naive, but maybe a little bit more transparent. You're laughing. That is extremely naive, Sarah. Okay, so...
We're women.
Okay, so where can we're people... Optimists. What'd you say?
We're optimists.
Well, you know, I like to... my cup is half full. Let's at least think... At least by splitting it out there, acknowledging it before it wasn't even acknowledged. So that's a little bit of a half full, you know?
Yeah, what's good about all these bad things happening is that it really shakes people up. They're ready for change. I mean, that's what, I think that's the best thing Trump did, was he's gotten everybody ready for, try something new. Whereas before, you know, you wouldn't dare touch like the Federal Reserve because it was so sort of holy and respectable. And now everybody's punching, you know, it's everybody's punching bag. So we're ready to think about redesigning it.
It should be, if you understand it, you know. So where can people see more of what you do? And are you going to be speaking anywhere or what?
I do have 3 conferences coming up. One in, it's the Left Coast Forum, which is in LA at the end of August. And then one in mid-September. It's California Vision 2020, Open Sacramento. It's all on my website. And then... Bioneers in October in San Rafael, California. So my website is ellenbrown.com and all those things are up there and all my articles are up there. And then there's the publicbankinginstitute.org, which has all the news. And then the movement right here in LA is really being pushed by Public Bank LA, which is these very dynamic millennials that are just great. And they do, you know, they know social media, so they do cute little videos. So all those are good resources.
So, but you have a newsletter as well where people can get your new articles that you write.
Yeah, Public Banking Institute has a newsletter.
Okay, excellent.
So you can go to their website or our website and click on the link.
Would you be interested in staying for 10 minutes and doing a little clip for my Patreons?
Sure. Okay.
Thank you so much.